From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama capped his trip to Africa Tuesday with a speech hailing the continent's progress, but warning such progress can be sustained only through continued development and democracy for all. Mr. Obama is now on his way back to Washington after making the first visit by a U.S. president to the African Union's headquarters in Ethiopia. He told African leaders of his personal interest in the continent's success, saying, quote, "I stand before you as a proud American. I also stand before you as the son of an African," end quote. The president hailed the continent's gains, from a plummeting HIV/AIDS infection rate to millions of Africans being lifted out of poverty, while noting the U.S. role in such gains. President Obama also said nothing will unlock Africa's economic potential more than ending the cancer of corruption.
"When someone has to pay a bribe just to start a business or go to school, or get an official to do the job they're supposed to be doing anyway, that's not the African way. It undermines the dignity of the people you represent. Only Africans can end corruption in their countries."
He said Africa's progress will also depend on democracy, free and fair elections, freedom of speech, press, and assembly. NATO held an unusual emergency meeting Tuesday to support Turkey, whose President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his forces are pressing their campaign against Islamic State militants and Kurdish rebels in Iraq. "No steps will be taken in our fight against terrorism," Mr. Erdogan said at a news conference in Ankara. "This will continue with the same determination." This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told skeptical lawmakers Tuesday that if the U.S. rejects the internationally brokered Iran nuclear deal, there would be no restraints on Tehran developing a nuclear weapon. "It's a good deal for the world, a good deal for America," Kerry told the House Foreign Affairs Committee. But Congressman Ed Royce, the Republican chairman of the Foreign Affairs Panel, asked, "Has Iran earned the right to be trusted? If this deal is approved, Iran gets a boost to its international stature." The lead Democrat on the subcommittee, or rather on the committee, Congressman Elliot Engel, said there are a number of issues he finds troublesome about the deal. 15 years from now, Iran will be essentially off the hook for compliance with the agreement, he said, a contention Kerry rejected. Congress has about 7 weeks left in the window to look over the agreement. A court in Libya issued a death sentence Tuesday to Saif al-Islam, a son of Muammar Gaddafi, in connection with a deadly response to the 2011 uprising that pushed Mr. Gaddafi from power. The Tripoli court also sentenced 8 others to death, including former spy chief Abdullah al-Sanusi and former Prime Minister Baghdadi Mahmoudi. Saif al-Islam was not in court Tuesday to hear the sentence. His verdict came in absentia because he is being held by a militia in the town of Zintan, which backs the internationally recognized government in Tobruk. U.S.-based Human Rights Watch said the trial was undermined by serious due process violations and called for an independent review by the Supreme Court. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak, who is under increasing pressure because of serious fraud allegations, has fired his deputy and attorney general. In a televised address Tuesday, Mr. Najib announced the dismissal of Deputy Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin, who had been one of his fiercest critics. He replaced him with Home Minister Zahid Hamidi. Malaysia's attorney general has helped lead an investigation into whether the prime minister received over $700 million from the government-owned 1MBD investment fund. Mr. Najib has denied any wrongdoing. Trading in China was volatile Tuesday, but ended lower a day after the country's stocks suffered their steepest plunge in 8 years. The benchmark Shanghai Composite Index closed down about 1.7% after falling as much as 5% after opening. On Monday, the index lost 8.5%, which is the biggest single-day plunge since the year 2007. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I stand before you as a proud American. I also stand before you as the son of an African. Africa and its people helped to shape America and allowed it to become the great nation that it is, and Africa and its people have helped shape who I am and how I see the world.
That's President Barack Obama speaking this evening before the African Union in Addis Ababa. Tonight, you'll hear Mr. Obama's speech in its entirety.
President Obama has addressed the African Union in a historic speech that covered a wide range of topics, including women's and gender rights, term limits, South Sudan, and economic growth. His remarks at the AU headquarters in Addis Ababa follow a meeting with AU Commission Chair Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma and a tour of a food processing factory. Mr. Obama met yesterday with Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn for what he called frank discussions that included urging the government to allow journalists and opposition parties to operate more freely. He said creating space for those voices will strengthen rather than inhibit the ruling party's agenda. Here now is President Obama's address before the AU, recorded earlier this evening.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, Madam Chairwoman, thank you so much for your kind words and your leadership. To Prime Minister Haile Mariam and the people of Ethiopia, once again, thank you for your wonderful hospitality and for hosting this Pan-African institution. To members of the African Union, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for welcoming me here today. It is a great honor to be the first President of the United States to address the African Union. I'm grateful for this opportunity to speak to the representatives of more than 1 billion people of the great African continent. We're joined today by citizens, by leaders of civil society, by faith communities, and I'm especially pleased to see so many young people who embody the energy and optimism of today's Africa. Hello. Thank you for being here. I stand before you as a proud American. I also stand before you as the son of an African. Africa and its people helped to shape America and allowed it to become the great nation that it is, and Africa and its people have helped shape who I am and how I see the world. In the villages in Kenya where my father was born, I learned of my ancestors and the life of my grandfather, the dreams of my father, the bonds of family that connect us all as Africans and Americans. As parents, Michelle and I want to make sure that our two daughters know their heritage, European and African, in all of its strengths and all of its struggle. So we've taken our daughters and stood with them on the shores of West Africa, in those doors of no return, mindful that their ancestors were both slaves and slave owners. We've stood with them in that small cell on Robben Island, where Madiba showed the world that no matter the nature of his physical confinement, he alone was the master of his fate. For us, for our children, Africa and its people teach us a powerful lesson, that we must uphold the inherent dignity of every human being. Dignity, that basic idea that by virtue of our common humanity, no matter where we come from or what we look like, we are all born equal, touched by the grace of God. Every person has worth. Every person matters. Every person deserves to be treated with decency and respect. Throughout much of history, mankind did not see this. Dignity was seen as a virtue reserved to those of rank and privilege, kings and elders. It took a revolution of the spirit over many centuries to open our eyes to the dignity of every person. And around the world, generations have struggled to put this idea into practice in laws and in institutions. So too here in Africa. This is the cradle of humanity, and ancient African kingdoms were home to great libraries and universities. But the evil of slavery took root not only abroad, but here on the continent. Colonialism skewed Africa's economy and robbed people of their capacity to shape their own destiny. Eventually, liberation movements grew, and 50 years ago, in a great burst of self-determination, Africans rejoiced as foreign flags came down and your national flags went up. As South Africa's Albert Luthuli said at the time, the basis for peace and brotherhood in Africa is being restored by the resurrection of national sovereignty and independence, of equality and the dignity of man. A half century into this independence era, it is long past time to put aside old stereotypes of an Africa forever mired in poverty and conflict. The world must recognize Africa's extraordinary progress. Today, Africa is one of the fastest growing regions in the world. Africa's middle class is projected to grow to more than 1 billion consumers, with hundreds of mobile phones, hundreds of millions of mobile phones, surging access to the internet. Africans are beginning to leapfrog old technologies into new prosperity. Africa is on the move. A new Africa is emerging. Propelled by this progress and in partnership with the world, Africa has achieved historic gains in health. The rate of new HIV/AIDS infections has plummeted. African mothers are more likely to survive childbirth and have healthy babies. Deaths from malaria have been slashed, saving the lives of millions of African children. Millions have been lifted from extreme poverty. Africa has led the world in sending more children to school. In other words, more and more African men, women, and children are living with dignity and with hope. And Africa's progress can also be seen in the institutions that bring us together today. When I first came to Sub-Saharan Africa as a president, I said that Africa doesn't need strong men, it needs strong institutions. And one of those institutions can be the African Union. Here, you can come together with a shared commitment to human dignity and development. Here, your 54 nations pursue a common vision of an integrated, prosperous, and peaceful Africa. As Africa changes, I've called on the world to change its approach to Africa. So many Africans have told me, we don't want just aid, we want trade that fuels progress. We don't want patrons. We want partners who help us build our own capacity to grow. We don't want the indignity of dependence. We want to make our own choices and determine our own future. And as president, I've worked to transform America's relationship with Africa so that we're truly listening to our African friends and working together as equal partners. And I'm proud of the progress that we've made. We've boosted American exports to this region, part of trade that supports jobs for Africans and Americans. To sustain our momentum, and with the bipartisan support of some of the outstanding members of Congress who are here today, 20 of them who are here today, I recently signed the 10-year renewal of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, and I want to thank them all. Why don't they stand very briefly so you can see them, because they've done outstanding work. We've launched major initiatives to promote food security and public health and access to electricity and to prepare the next generation of African leaders and entrepreneurs, investments that will help fuel Africa's rise for decades to come. Last year, as the chairwoman noted, I welcomed nearly 50 African presidents and prime ministers to Washington so we could begin a new chapter of cooperation. And by coming to the African Union today, I'm looking to build on that commitment. I believe Africa's rise is not just important for Africa, it's important to the entire world. We will not be able to meet the challenges of our time, from ensuring a strong global economy, to facing down violent extremism, to combating climate change, to ending hunger and extreme poverty, without the voices and contributions of 1 billion Africans. Now, even with Africa's impressive progress, we must acknowledge that many of these gains rest on a fragile foundation. Alongside new wealth, hundreds of millions of Africans still endure extreme poverty. Alongside high-tech hubs of innovation, many Africans are crowded into shanty towns without power or running water, a level of poverty that's an assault on human dignity. Moreover, as the youngest and fastest growing continent, Africa's population in the coming decades will double to some 2 billion people, and many of them will be young, under 18. Now, on the one hand, this could bring tremendous opportunities as these young Africans harness new technologies and ignite new growth and reforms. Economists will tell you that countries, regions, continents grow faster with younger populations. It's a demographic edge and advantage. But only if those young people are being trained. We need only to look at the Middle East and North Africa to see that large numbers of young people with no jobs and stifled voices can fuel instability and disorder. I suggest to you that the most urgent task facing Africa today and for decades ahead is to create opportunity for this next generation. And this will be an enormous undertaking. Africa will need to generate millions more jobs than it's doing right now, and time is of the essence. The choices made today will shape the trajectory of Africa and therefore the world for decades to come. And as your partner and your friend, allow me to suggest several ways that we can meet this challenge together. Africa's progress will depend on unleashing economic growth, not just for the few at the top, but for the many, because an essential element of dignity is being able to live a decent life. That begins with a job, and that requires trade and investment. Many of your nations have made important reforms to attract investment. It's been a spark for growth. But in many places across Africa, it's still too hard to start a venture, still too hard to build a business. Governments that take additional reforms to make doing business easier will have an eager partner in the United States. And that includes reforms to help Africa trade more with itself, as the chairwoman and I discussed before we came out here today, because the biggest markets for your goods are often right next door. You don't have to just look overseas for growth. You can look internally. And our work to help Africa modernize customs and border crossings started with the East African community. Now we're expanding our efforts across the continent, because it shouldn't be harder for African countries to trade with each other than it is for you to trade with Europe and America.
You're listening to President Obama's address before the African Union, recorded earlier this evening. This is the voice of America.
South Africa, Nigeria, and Angola. And much of that is in the form of energy. I want Africans and Americans doing more business together in more sectors, in more countries. So we're increasing trade missions to places like Tanzania, Ethiopia, Mozambique. We're working to help more Africans get their goods to market. Next year, we'll host another U.S.-Africa business forum to mobilize billions of dollars in new trade and investment. So we're buying more of each other's products and all growing together. Now, the United States isn't the only country that sees your growth as an opportunity, and that is a good thing. When more countries invest responsibly in Africa, it creates more jobs and prosperity for us all. So I want to encourage everybody to do business with Africa. And African countries should want to do business with every country. But economic relationships can't simply be about building countries' infrastructure with foreign labor or extracting Africa's natural resources. Real economic partnerships have to be a good deal for Africa. They have to create jobs and capacity for Africans. And that includes the point that Chairwoman Zuma made about illicit flows with multinationals, which is one of the reasons that we've been a leading advocate working with the G7 to assist in making sure that there's honest accounting when businesses are investing here in the United here in Africa, and making sure that capital flows are properly accounted for. That's the kind of partnership America offers. Nothing will unlock Africa's economic potential more than ending the cancer of corruption. And you are right that it is not just a problem of Africa, it is a problem of those who do business with Africa. It is not unique to Africa. Corruption exists all over the world, including in the United States. But here in Africa, corruption drains billions of dollars from economies that can't afford to lose billions of dollars. That's money that could be used to create jobs and build hospitals and schools. And when someone has to pay a bribe just to start a business or go to school or get an official to do the job they're supposed to be doing anyway, that's not the African way. It undermines the dignity of the people you represent. Only Africans can end corruption in their countries. As African governments commit to take action, the United States will work with you to combat illicit financing and promote good governance and transparency and rule of law. And we already have strong laws in place that say to U.S. companies, you can't engage in bribery to try to get business, which not all countries have. And we actually enforce it and police it. And let me add that criminal networks are both fueling corruption and threatening Africa's precious wildlife, and with it, the tourism that many African economies count on. So America also stands with you in the fight against wildlife trafficking. That's something that has to be addressed. But ultimately, the most powerful antidote to the old ways of doing things is this new generation of African youth. History shows that the nations that do best are the ones that invest in the education of their people. You see, in this information age, jobs can flow anywhere. and they typically will flow to where workers are literate and highly skilled and online. And Africa's young people are ready to compete. I've met them. They are hungry. They are eager. They're willing to work hard. So we've got to invest in them. As Africa invests in education, our entrepreneurship programs are helping innovators start new businesses and create jobs right here in Africa. And the men and women in our Young African Leaders Initiative today will be the leaders who can transform business and civil society and governments tomorrow. Africa's progress will depend on development that truly lifts countries from poverty to prosperity. Because people everywhere deserve the dignity of a life free from want. A child born in Africa today is just as equal and just as worthy as a child born in Asia or Europe or America. At the recent development conference here in Addis, African leadership helped forge a new global compact for financing that fuels development. And under the AU's leadership, the voice of a united Africa will help shape the world's next set of development goals. And you're pursuing a vision of the future that you want for Africa. And America's approach to development, the central focus of our engagement with Africa, is focused on helping you build your own capacity to realize that vision. Instead of just shipping food aid to Africa, we've helped more than 2 million farmers use new techniques to boost their yields, feed more people, reduce hunger. With our new alliance of government and the private sector investing billions of dollars in African agriculture, I believe we can achieve our goal and lift 50 million Africans from poverty. Instead of just sending aid to build power plants, our Power Africa initiative is mobilizing billions of dollars in investment from governments and businesses to reduce the number of Africans living without electricity. Now, an undertaking of this magnitude will not be quick. It will take many years. But working together, I believe we can bring electricity to more than 60 million African homes and businesses and connect more Africans to the global economy. Instead of just telling Africa you're on your own in dealing with climate change, we're delivering new tools and financing to more than 40 African nations to help them prepare and adapt. By harnessing the wind and sun, your vast geothermal energy, and rivers for hydropower, you can turn this climate threat into an economic opportunity. And I urge Africa to join us in rejecting old divides between North and South so we can forge a strong global climate agreement this year.
You are listening to President Obama's address before the African Union recorded earlier this evening. This is the Voice of America.
Shortages of water and food is a matter of survival and a matter of human dignity. Instead of just sending medicine, we're investing in better treatments and helping Africa prevent and treat diseases. As the United States continues to provide billions of dollars in the fight against HIV/AIDS, and as your countries take greater ownership of health programs, we're moving toward a historic accomplishment, the first AIDS-free generation. And if the world learned anything from Ebola, it's that the best way to prevent epidemics is to build strong public health systems that stop diseases from spreading in the first place. So America is proud to partner with the AU and African countries in this mission. Today I can announce that of the $1 billion that the United States is devoting to this work globally, half will support efforts here in Africa. I believe Africa's progress will also depend on democracy, because Africans, like people everywhere, deserve the dignity of being in control of their own lives. We all know what the ingredients of real democracy are. They include free and fair elections, but also freedom of speech and the press, freedom of assembly. These rights are universal. They're written into African constitutions. The African Charter on Human and People's Rights declares that every individual shall have the right to the respect of the dignity inherent in a human being. From Sierra Leone, Ghana, Benin, to Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, democracy has taken root. In Nigeria, more than 28 million voters bravely cast their ballots and power transferred as it should, peacefully. Yet at this very moment, these same freedoms are denied to many Africans. And I have to proclaim, democracy is not just formal elections. You know, when journalists are put behind bars for doing their jobs, or activists are threatened as governments crack down on civil society, then you may have democracy in name, but not in substance. And I'm convinced that nations cannot realize the full promise of independence until they fully protect the rights of their people. And this is true even for countries that have made important democratic progress. As I indicated during my visit to Kenya, the remarkable gains that country has made with a new constitution, with its election, cannot be jeopardized by restrictions on civil society. You know, likewise, our hosts, Ethiopians, have much to be proud of. I've been amazed at all the wonderful work that's being done here. And it's true that the elections that took place here occurred without violence. But as I discussed with Prime Minister Haile Mariam, that's just the start of democracy. I believe Ethiopia will not fully unleash the potential of its people if journalists are restricted or legitimate opposition groups can't participate in the campaign process. And to his credit, the Prime Minister acknowledged that more work will need to be done for Ethiopia to be a full-fledged, sustainable democracy. So these are conversations we have to have as friends. You know, American democracy is not perfect. We've worked for many years. But one thing we do is we continually re-examine to figure out how can we make our democracy better. And that's a source of strength for us, being willing to look and see honestly what we need to be doing to fulfill the promise of our founding documents. And every country has to go through that process. No country is perfect, but we have to be honest and strive to expand freedoms, to broaden democracy. The bottom line is that when citizens cannot exercise their rights, the world has a responsibility to speak out. And America will, even if it's sometimes uncomfortable. Even when it's sometimes directed towards our friends. And I know that there are some countries that don't say anything. And maybe that's easier to, you know, for leaders to deal with. But you're kind of stuck with us. This is how we are. We believe in these things. We're going to keep on talking about it. And I want to repeat, we do this not because we think our democracy is perfect or we think that every country has to follow precisely our path. For more than two centuries since our independence, we're still working on perfecting our union. We're not immune from criticism. When we fall short of our ideals, we strive to do better. But when we speak out for our principles, at home and abroad, we stay true to our values, and we help lift up the lives of people beyond our borders. And we think that's important. And it's especially important, I believe, for those of us of African descent, because we've known what it feels like to be on the receiving end of injustice. We know what it means to be discriminated against. We know what it means to be jailed. So how can we stand by when it's happening to somebody else? I'll be frank with you, it can't just be America that's talking about these things. Fellow African countries have to talk about these things. All right, just as other countries championed your break from colonialism, our nations must all raise our voices when universal rights are being denied. For if we truly believe that Africans are equal in dignity, that Africans have an equal right to freedoms that are universal, that's a principle we all have to defend. And it's not just a Western idea. It's a human idea. I have to also say that Africa's democratic progress is also at risk when leaders refuse to step aside when their terms end. Now, let me be honest with you. I do not understand this. I am in my second term. It has been an extraordinary privilege for me to serve as the President of the United States. I cannot imagine a greater honor or a more interesting job. I love my work. But under our Constitution, I cannot run again. I can't run again. I actually think I'm a pretty good president. I think if I ran, I could win. But I can't. So there's a lot that I'd like to do to keep America moving, but the law is the law. And no one person is above the law, not even the president. And I'll be honest with you, I'm looking forward to life after being president. I won't have such a big security detail all the time. It means I can go take a walk. I can spend time with my family. I can find other ways to serve. I can visit Africa more often. The point is, I don't understand why people want to stay so long. Especially when they've got a lot of money. When a leader tries to change the rules in the middle of the game just to stay in office, it risks instability and strife, as we've seen in Burundi. And this is often just a first step down a perilous path. And sometimes you'll hear a leader say, well, I'm the only person who can hold this nation together. If that's true, then that leader has failed to truly build their nation. You look at Nelson Mandela. Madiba, like George Washington, forged a lasting legacy, not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully. And just as the African Union has condemned coups and illegitimate transfers of power, the AU's authority and strong voice can also help the people of Africa ensure that their leaders abide by term limits and their constitutions. Nobody should be president for life. And your country's better off if you have new blood and new ideas. I'm still a pretty young man. I'm still a pretty young man, but I know that somebody with new energy and new insights will be good for my country. It will be good for yours, too, in some cases. Africa's progress will also depend on security and peace, because an essential part of human dignity is being safe and free from fear. In Angola, Mozambique, Liberia, Sierra Leone, we've seen conflicts end and countries work to rebuild. But from Somalia and Nigeria to Mali and Tunisia, terrorists continue to target innocent civilians. Many of these groups claim the banner of religion, but hundreds of millions of African Muslims know that Islam means peace. And we must call groups like Al-Qaeda, ISIL, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, we must call them what they are, murderers. In the face of threats, Africa and the African Union has shown leadership. Because of the AU force in Somalia, Al-Shabaab controls less territory and the Somali government is growing stronger. In Central Africa, the AU-led mission continues to degrade the Lord's Resistance Army. In the Lake Chad Basin, forces from several nations with the backing of the AU are fighting to end Boko Haram's senseless brutality. And today we salute all those who serve to protect the innocent, including so many brave African peacekeepers. Now, as Africa stands against terror and conflict, I want you to know that the United States stands with you. With training and support, we're helping African forces grow stronger. The United States is supporting the AU's effort to strengthen peacekeeping, and we're working with countries in the region to deal with emerging crises with the African Peacekeeping Rapid Response Partnership. The world must do more to help as well. This fall at the United Nations, I will host a summit to secure new commitments to strengthen international support for peacekeeping, including here in Africa. And building on commitments that originated here in the AU, we'll work to develop a new partnership between the UN and the AU that can provide reliable support for AU peace operations. If African governments and international partners step up with strong support, we can transform how we work together to promote security and peace in Africa. Now, our efforts to ensure our shared security must be matched by a commitment to improve governance. Those things are connected. Good governance is one of the best weapons against terrorism and instability. Our fight against terrorist groups, for example, will never be won if we fail to address legitimate grievances that terrorists may try to exploit. If we don't build trust with all communities, if we don't uphold the rule of law. There's a saying, and I believe it is true, if we sacrifice liberty in the name of security, we risk losing both. This same seriousness of purpose is needed to end conflicts. In the Central African Republic, the spirit of dialogue recently shown by ordinary citizens must be matched by leaders committed to inclusive elections and a peaceful transition. In Mali, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement must be fulfilled. And leaders in Sudan must know their nation will never truly thrive so long as they wage war against their own people. The world will not forget about Darfur. In South Sudan, the joy of independence has descended into the despair of violence. I was there at the United Nations when we held up South Sudan as the promise of a new beginning. And neither Mr. Kiir nor Mr. Machar have shown so far any interest in sparing their people from this suffering or reaching a political solution. Yesterday, I met with leaders from this region. We agree that given the current situation, Mr. Kiir and Mr. Machar must reach an agreement by August 17th, because if they do not, I believe the international community must raise the costs of intransigence. And the world awaits the report of the AU Commission of Inquiry, because accountability for atrocities must be part of any lasting peace in Africa's youngest nation. And finally, Africa's progress will depend on upholding the human rights of all people, for if each of us is to be treated with dignity, each of us must be sure to also extend that same dignity to others. As president, I make it a point to meet with many of our young African leaders, and one was a young man from Senegal. He said something wonderful about being together with so many of his African brothers and sisters. He said, "Here I have met Africa, the Africa I've always believed in. She's beautiful, she's young, She's full of talent and motivation and ambition. I agree. Africa is the beautiful, talented daughters who are just as capable as Africa's sons. And as a father, I believe that my two daughters have to have the same chance to pursue their dreams as anybody's son. And that same thing holds true for girls here in Africa. Our girls have to be treated the same. We can't let old traditions stand in the way. The march of history shows that we have the capacity to broaden our moral imaginations. We come to see that some traditions are good for us. They keep us grounded. But that in our modern world, other traditions set us back. When African girls are subjected to the mutilation of their bodies or forced into marriage at the ages of 9 or 10 or 11, that sets us back. That's not a good tradition. It needs to end. When more than 80% of new HIV cases in the hardest hit countries are teenage girls, that's a tragedy. That sets us back. So America's beginning a partnership with 10 African countries: Kenya, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, South Africa, Swaziland, Tanzania, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, to keep teenage girls safe and AIDS-free. And when girls cannot go to school and grow up not knowing how to read or write, that denies the world future women engineers, future women doctors, future women business owners, future women presidents. That sets us all back. That's a bad tradition, not providing our girls the same education as our sons. I was saying in Kenya, nobody would put out a football team and then just play half the team. You'd lose. The same is true when it comes to getting everybody an education. You can't leave half the team off, our young women. So as part of America's support for the education and the health of our daughters, my wife, Michelle, is helping to lead a global campaign, including a new effort in Tanzania and Malawi, with a simple message. Let girls learn. Let girls learn so they grow up healthy and they grow up strong, and that will be good for families, and they will raise smart, healthy children, and that will be good for every one of your nations. Africa is the beautiful, strong women that these girls grow up to become. The single best indicator of whether a nation will succeed is how it treats its women.
You're listening to President Obama's address before the African Union, recorded earlier this evening. This is the voice of America.
Communities are more prosperous. Children do better in school. Nations are more prosperous. Look at the amazing African women here in this hall. If you want your country to grow and succeed, you have to empower your women. And if you want to empower more women, America will be your partner. Let's work together to stop sexual assault and domestic violence. Let's make clear that we will not tolerate rape as a weapon of war. It's a crime, and those who commit it must be punished. Let's lift up the next generation of women leaders who can help fight injustice and forge peace and start new businesses and create jobs. And some might hire some men, too. We'll all be better off when women have equal futures. And Africa is the beautiful tapestry of your cultures and ethnicities and races and religions. Last night, we saw this amazing dance troupe made up of street children who had formed a dance troupe, and they performed for the Prime Minister and myself. And there are 80 different languages, and I don't know how many ethnic groups. And there were like 30 different dances that were being done, and the Prime Minister was trying to keep up with, okay, I think that's one Zomoro. And they were moving fast. And that diversity here in Ethiopia is representative of diversity all throughout Africa. And that's a strength. Now, yesterday I had the privilege to view Lucy. You may know Lucy. She's our ancestor, more than 3 million years old. In this tree of humanity, with all of our branches and diversity, we all go back to the same root. We're all one family. We're all one tribe. And yet so much of the suffering in our world stems from our failure to remember that, to not recognize ourselves in each other. We think because somebody's skin is slightly different, or their hair is slightly different, or their religious faith is differently expressed, or they speak a different language, that it justifies somehow us treating them with less dignity. And that becomes the source of so many of our problems. And we think somehow that we make ourselves better by putting other people down. And that becomes the source of so many of our problems. When we begin to see each other as somehow less than ourselves, when we succumb to these artificial divisions of faith or sect or tribe or ethnicity, then even the most awful abuses are justified in the minds of those in those ways. And in the end, abusers lose their own humanity as well. Nelson Mandela taught us, to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. Every one of us is equal. Every one of us has worth. Every one of us matters. And when we respect the freedom of others, no matter the color of their skin or how they pray or who they are or who they love, we are all more free. Your dignity depends. Your dignity depends on my dignity, and my dignity depends on yours. Imagine if everyone had that spirit in their hearts. Imagine if governments operated that way. Just imagine what the world could look like, the future that we could bequeath these young people. Yes, in our world, old thinking can be a stubborn thing. That's one of the reasons why we need term limits. Old people think old ways. And you can see my gray hair, I'm getting old. The old ways can be stubborn. But I believe the human heart is stronger. I believe hearts can change. I believe minds can open. That's how change happens. That's how societies move forward. It's not always a straight line. Step by halting step. Sometimes you go forward, you move back a little bit. But I believe we are marching. We are pointing towards ideals of justice and equality. That's how your nations won independence. Not just with rifles, but with principles and ideals. That's how African Americans won our civil rights. That's how South Africans, black and white, tore down apartheid. That's why I can stand before you today as the first African American president of the United States. New thinking, unleashing growth that creates opportunity, promoting development that lifts all people out of poverty, supporting democracy that gives citizens their say, advancing the security and justice that delivers peace, respecting the human rights of all people. These are the keys to progress, not just in Africa, but around the world. And this is the work that we can do together. And I am hopeful. As I prepare to return home, my thoughts are with that same young man from Senegal who said, here I have met Africa, the Africa I have always believed in. She is beautiful and young, full of talent and motivation and ambition. To which I would simply add, as you build the Africa you believe in, you will have no better partner, no better friend than the United States of America. God bless Africa. God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
That was President Obama speaking this evening at the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa.
President Barack Obama has wrapped up his visit to East Africa and is on his way home. Before leaving, Mr. Obama took the time to meet personally with Ethiopians who have benefited from U.S. development initiatives. Reporter Anita Powell is in Addis Ababa and reports on how Ethiopia welcomed his visit.
Ethiopian farmer Gifty Jamal Hussein beamed as she looked up into the face of President Obama and told him how he changed her life. Through a U.S. development project started by Mr. Obama, she had access to better seeds, which vastly improved her corn harvest. That success allowed her to send her children to school, to buy a cow, and to build a better house. Mr. Obama's visit to this East African regional power has focused on the key issues of security and development. But Ethiopia is perhaps best known for famine and poverty, and has tried hard to shed that past. Mr. Obama said his project, called Feed the Future, is trying to help Ethiopia do that. The United States has historically been the largest donor to Ethiopia, but Mr. Obama said the project's goal is to work more intelligently, not just to pour in more money.
With just a few smart interventions, a little bit of help, they can make huge improvements in their overall yields.
On Tuesday, Mr. Obama visited a factory on Addis Ababa's outskirts that, with help from American companies, manufactures fortified foods like bread and baby cereals. Fafa Foods manager Zeko Ebro says his factory represents a new model for Africa that allows the continent to improve its destiny from within. Because Fafa Foods is a local manufacturer, it creates jobs and adds to the economy while providing a necessary product.
Our factory's special mission is producing nutritious food with affordable price to the whole population. And that is what makes us special by visited by President of the United States of America.
For farmers like Gifty, however, these big ideas have very real consequences. When asked about her reaction to meeting Mr. Obama, she grinned and offered a one-word response.
Amasaganallo.
It means thank you. Anita Powell, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
And that wraps up this special edition of African News Tonight. Up next will be our VOA editorial. I'm Yehius Huhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbuganyi, and our engineer, Bill Barber, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.